Hello, my name is Tucker Johnson, and I am your host today as we experience NIMSY Live, where we talk about the latest and greatest in translation, localization, internationalization, culturalization, and all that fun stuff global companies need to delight their international customers. On this program, we invite guests who like to have fun and have some value to add for our audience of globalization professionals. I'm always eager to provide a platform to those with a good story or a good data set. So let us know if there are any topics you'd like covered or guests we should reach out to for future episodes. If you haven't already done so, make sure that you are subscribed to or following NIMSY Insights on your platform of choice. We are coming to you live today on LinkedIn, Facebook, X, and YouTube, of course, where all of our episodes are archived over on our NIMSY Insights YouTube channel. So you can go back and see the previous 128 episodes at your leisure. Before we get into it today, I just want to give a quick shout out to Multilingual Magazine. Multilingual Magazine is our sister company here at NIMSY Insights. You can go over to multilingual.com. They are providing daily news. It's not just a magazine. They are providing daily news on the state of the language services industry and all things localization, as well as, of course, their monthly print magazine, which goes out to over 100 countries worldwide. So if you are not subscribed to Multilingual Magazine, now is your chance. You should go over to multilingual.com and do so. So,
second.
Bill seconds that.
Yes, my article on it.
and read Carol's article, which we're going to be talking about today. So getting right into it. Today we are discussing the new executive order signed by President Trump on March 1st, 2025, officially designating English as the language of the United States. This order also revokes Executive Order 13166, which for over 25 years required federally funded agencies to provide language access for limited English proficient individuals. Joining us today is Carol Valandia Prado, founder of Equal Access Language Services and a leading expert on language access policy, and of course, Dr. Bill Rivers, who was just with me last week as well, who is the industry's foremost language access advocate, lobbyist, consultant. He's been busy since Trump came into office. Let's just put it that way. We're going to be discussing what this order means for language services providers, translators, and interpreters, and the millions of Americans who rely on multilingual services every day. Carol, Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tucker, for having us.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for the invite, and always happy to talk about anything to do with the language industry.
Yeah, and Bill, we were just talking last week on Friday, and at that point, we hadn't really gotten... We knew that Trump was going to sign an order designating English as the national language of the U.S., but we didn't have the text of the order itself. And I'm going to bring up on screen here the actual order. I dropped a link into LinkedIn. So for those of us following along on LinkedIn, you can go reference it on a new tab. But could you just give us a quick summary of what is actually in the order here?
So there are really two or maybe two and a half things. The first is that the executive order declares that English is the official language of the United States. And that's the shortest part of the executive order. And we'll talk about what that actually means, I'm sure, through the course of the live stream. The second part is that, as you noted, it revokes Executive Order 13166, which was signed by President Bill Clinton in August of 2000, published formally on August 14th of 2000. And without going into too much detail, it requires the agencies of the federal government to have language access policies and plans, and it requires recipients of federal funding to not discriminate based on language status. And so that's the real meat of it from the industry's point of view, and we'll talk about why that is the case, I'm sure. And the sort of two and a half thing it does, it tells the Department of Justice to unpublish, if that's a word, you know, all of its guidance on language access, or, you know, all of it. So, you know, it, as an executive order, it binds only the executive branch of the federal government. So the quick primer on U.S. civics is you've got Congress sets up in Article 1, the Congress, and gives it specific powers. Article 2, the President, whose primary job in Article 2 is to faithfully execute the laws of the United States, and then Article 3 is the federal courts. So when the president gives an executive order, really it's only binding on the executive branch. And so that's the first piece. And then, you know, we'll get into the sort of the import of the rest of it. I don't want to go on for too long now because I should let other people talk.
Just really quickly, like, Carol, I want to come to you too, Carol, but really quickly, you mentioned, you know, rescinding a bunch of stuff. That is what the order says. And as I was preparing for this today, I was trying to pull up some different tabs here, and I was trying to pull up a copy of Executive Order 13166 and 404 not found. Published anymore, unless I'm just...
Well, it's not going to be available on any of the federal websites. If you look in, the Federal Register, which is the official record of the doings of the executive branch, it is still in the Federal Register. They can't really unpublish something that was published 25 years ago in print.
Got it. Okay. And Carol, what are your thoughts, opening thoughts?
Well, my thought is that the order is very broad, right? And when it rescinds Executive Order 13166, it really, and I'm going to read a little piece that I actually took the time to translate into my analogy, right? Because I have been trying to think of a good example so that it can relate to people. It says, nothing in this order, however, requires or directs any change in the services provided by any agency. Agency heads should make decisions as they deem necessary to fulfill their respective agency's missions and effectively provide government services to the American people. Agency heads are not required to amend, remove, or otherwise stop production of documents, products, or other services prepared or offered in languages other than English. So what that really means, and the translation I offer is the equivalent of saying that all Americans enjoy the freedom of an open road, and that they have decided to revoke all road maps and traffic laws, but not to worry because you still can drive. Right. But each driver can decide for themselves how best to reach their destination, free from the constraints of standardized signs and signals. Right. Of course, you're not required to stop using those signals, turn signals or whatever signal. You can just drive as you see fit and enjoy the new efficiency of the open road. So that's really what it means. It's like we don't have a guideline.
So it's not that we're not forbidding anything. We're not taking anything away. We're just saying that we don't need to regulate this. We don't need to enforce provision of language services, essentially.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's the challenge in that from the perspective of the federal government and saying, okay, each agency, the Department of Housing and Urban Development or the Department of Veterans Affairs or Department of Transportation is now on its own as to whether they need to have language access policies and plans and to provide guidance to the recipients of their funds. There are a couple of really important challenges that arise from that. First is, for the last 23 years, I think, so the executive order was published in August 2000, and then detailed guidance was published a couple of years later in 2002, if I remember correctly. I mean, this is a long time ago now. Recipients of federal funding, whether they are grantees or contractors, whether it is a state government or a local government that gets its funding indirectly from the federal government through the state government, whether it's a local community organization or, you know, whatever it is, the local school system, they're all bound by Title VI, the Civil Rights Act. And Title VI says, no one shall be discriminated against based on this list of protected categories, one of which is national origin. Mm. So that means no one. It means no one person, number one. And that national origin, thanks to a Supreme Court case in 1974, Lau versus Nichols, national origin is interpreted as including language status. And the Lau case is interesting because that was San Francisco Unified School District was sued by the family of a Cantonese-speaking, with Cantonese-speaking children, and the allegation was they were not providing an equal education. And the Supreme Court found unanimously in 1974, 9-0, that this was discriminatory under Title VI based on national origin, that language status was tantamount to national origin. Those things, Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, the Lau v. Nichols case, and then some more specific federal laws about that impact language access. For example, Section 1557 of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Section 1557 also prohibits discrimination based on a range of categories, protected categories, one of which is explicitly language status. There are analogous provisions or similar provisions in any number of other federal laws, like the Fair Housing Act, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, where language access is, where language discrimination is prohibited. And so the executive orders can't make law. Congress makes laws. Executive orders cannot overturn court cases. The Supreme Court overturns court cases, including its own, or, you know, that they're the Supreme Court. So, you know, this executive order takes away some of the quasi-regulatory, because it's not really a regulation, it's an executive order.
Right.
Doesn't have the force of law outside the executive branch, but it does take away the scaffolding of language access in agencies that don't have anything that stands between Title VI, which is much broader and kind of higher level, and, you know, specific issues of language access. And there's the real potential that those agencies will then, you know, dial back their, their guidance, dial back their enforcement through the offices of civil rights. Potential, because one of the things that I'm a lobbyist and consultant, and I've been spending a lot of the last month saying, you know, we have to react to things that actually happen, not things that might happen.
Right.
And so, you know, we have to see if this is going to have an impact. If it does, then there are steps that the language industry can take. There's steps that, you know, patient advocates can take, civil rights organizations can take. But we can't let the hyperbole and the hype, which are probably the same thing, we can't let that dictate our actions.
Well, I will disagree on this, because the truth is that a lot of things have already happened. Like, if the fact that we have those rights doesn't mean that we have preserved those rights. In fact, since we have had Executive Order 13166, hospitals still 20 years later sometimes will not offer interpretation services or will continue to use children for interpretation services. That continues to happen. So the fact that the right exists doesn't mean that people implement the law. And I think that we already have to be active on this, right? And that's the whole purpose of advocacy. So I don't think we should sit and wait what's going to happen, because the truth is that these mandates have not been fully implemented. In fact, in my work, what I see every day when I go to the courts or when I go to the hospitals as an interpreter, I see that people are still complaining that they were not offered an interpreter at this point or at this other point. So the problem is still exists, despite the fact that we have had Executive Order 13166. So what this new regulation is going to do is like, oh, never mind the little changes we were already starting to happen. Now we're going to even remove that. And I have noticed, for example, in the past 5 years, I've noticed a change in culture around the topic of language access. I can tell you that 3 years ago, when I said that I work on language access, people would think I taught Spanish or that I taught English or something, nothing to do with language access, right? So the concept today is being more broadly understood, and that's great. And so we were at the point where we were reaching that critical mass of people understanding what language access was all about. And then, boom, this executive order came. So the good part, though, is that now many more people know what language access is. Many more people understand the role they play in language access, especially interpreters.
Sure.
Interpreters were not aware of Executive Order 13166. I belong to at least 10 different chats of interpreters, and they had no idea, many of them, I'm not saying all of them, but many of them didn't know anything about Executive Order 13166. Now they do, because now what they took for granted by not knowing, when you take for granted something, you usually don't know what you're what you don't have, right? Now that's been removed. Now they're like, oh, wait, we had that and that protect this right? And how did that work? And oh my God, am I part of language access? So they were starting to perceive themselves that way, right? So we were having that momentum. And you know, the reality about this new regulation is that it might actually push the momentum in the positive, being like, oh my God, we're going to now make sure that we portrayed ourselves as the language access executors, right? So we hope that. But so I think that things have already happened and we don't need to wait for that to occur, to jump, you know?
I think what I really specifically meant, because I agree, Carol, that the knowledge of the rights around language access and how to secure those rights if you're a limited English proficient individual, how to provide language access if you're on the other side as a service provider. That has been a work in progress since forever, since 25 years ago, in fact, longer. And, you know, I'm still surprised. Tucker knows this very well. We had a project where writing a language access policy for a client, and some of the community-based organizations that worked with that client, they didn't know about language access as a right, and were, you know, not responding appropriately when told, you know, when one of their community members was told, well, come back with an interpreter. It's like, no, actually, you got to supply the interpreter to your job. Okay, that's an evergreen challenge. What I think this, my concern with this executive order, I like your optimistic point that this will make language access more salient and we might see better provision, but I'm concerned about entities that might say, you know, covered entities is federal jargon, might say, oh, we're not required to do this anymore. Well, wait a minute. In fact, you are. It's still the law of the land. You're going to get less guidance, potentially less guidance from the federal government, potentially less enforcement, because the enforcement mechanism goes through the Office of Civil Rights. You have to file a complaint. And not many people understand that process very well. So that's, I think you have that concern, but it's also the overall messaging of it, that this is somehow costly and, divisive, when in fact there's, like in the healthcare sector, there's, and educational sector to a lesser degree, ample high quality research going back now almost 40 years, that when you provide quality language access to patients, you get better patients' adherence to instructions, you get fewer readmissions, you get fewer malpractice claims, your patients live better, longer, healthier lives, and you spend less money taking care of them than if you provide, you know, when you provide the language access than when you don't. Is that well understood? Yeah. I don't know.
Right. I don't think it is. I think
I don't think it is.
I totally agree. And I think among the beliefs that are so pervasive, that have endured for a long time, that I think we're going to unfortunately revert to those beliefs, perhaps, is that first, in America, we speak English, right? The executive order clearly says that we have been an English speaker, right? English speaking country. Claro, of course, por supuesto. So, but that is a fallacy, right? We have been multilingual since inception. And actually the percentage of non-English speakers in the US has continued to be 20%. I think Bill always mentions the 68 million people. That's about 68 million people that don't speak 68 million people that speak a language other than English at home. That's still 20% of our population. And that it was like that at the beginning of the country when there were a lot of Dutch speakers, German speakers, and so we have always been multilingual. That is belief number one that has been pervasive. And I think what the executive order is doing regarding that belief is that if you foster any type of racist belief about people speaking other language, this is going to emphasize that belief and you are going to act accordingly. So for example, the physicians that will say to a patient, and I had to interpret this a couple of times, oh my God, 26 years and she still doesn't speak English, right? That we're gonna see perhaps more of that. The second belief is that the onus of providing language services is on the patient, for example, or on the person going to the court, or on the parents that are trying to register the kids at school, right? That is a belief that now that we were trying to remove from people through advocacy, and it's going to revert to that perhaps. So the big question is, okay, great, maybe interpretation services are going to still require, but how are they going to be provided? So that's the second belief I'm concerned about. And the third one is that, as Bill said, that language access is costly because you have to pay interpreters for that or translators for that. And the reality, as Bill says, that it saves enormous amount of money in wasteful spending. And I think the most startling number there is you know, healthcare, that's one fifth of our economy. 40% or 49% of that expense is wasteful spending. And a big percentage of this 49% is communication errors. And those communication errors, the great percent of these communication errors is run by 5% of the population that can communicate.
And malpractice.
That needs to be understood. In practice, it's going to be more expensive not to have language access. So I think we have to go into creating language access plans that are independent from what the government says. Just create your own. That's what we're going to have to do.
I've heard in the last, so it was Saturday was when this was issued, and now it's Thursday, so that's what, 5 or 6 days. I've heard from multiple healthcare systems, they're going to keep providing language access regardless. They understand that their provision of language access doesn't depend on Executive Order 13166 anyway. It depends on the Affordable Care Act and Section 1557 and Volume 45, Chapter 92 of the Code of Federal Regulations. So they understand those obligations. They also, you know, there are more progressive, if I can use that word, in 2025, more forward-looking, more thoughtful, more data-driven healthcare organizations that realize that there's an ROI for providing language access, that it does improve their bottom line. And we've talked about this as an industry, and I've been on other live streams with Tucker and Renato in the past, where, you know, as an industry, we end up selling a commodity into cost centers.
Right.
Right. So that becomes then completely price dependent.
Well, and this is where I just jump in here.
Making it not a cost center, right?
Exactly. And that's the mindset that we have to change, and regardless of what the federal government says. Because at the end of the day, the federal government, they can pull funding, as people are mentioning in the comments. They can't tell states what to do. They can't tell individuals what to do. They can tell hospitals what to do. But they can pull funding if certain guidelines aren't followed, as we just talked about last week, Bill. But to me, I think it's really short-sighted that us in this language access space typically immediately go to, but it's our right. It is our right as outlined in Title VI, as outlined in Executive Order 13166, blah, blah, blah. And we start hitting on that punching bag. But at the end of the day, it's like, yes, it is our right. And I'm not saying it's not. But at the end of the day, is that really a convincing argument to a profit-driven hospital organization, right? A much more convincing argument would be the ROI of providing language access, the reduced readmittance rate, the reduced length of stay, right? All of these things, the reduced malpractice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And executive order, whatever, you know, that's not taking any of those, that reality away.
Yeah, I think that when, at least from the industry perspective, when I work with my clients, I try to align with clients that align with my company's values, Equal Access Language Services, we're about that. And because of that, as you said, Tucker, they are not changing anything because the government is not going to tell them what to do or what not to do, except for the funds that come from the federal government. So that is extremely important that they are following those values as well. However, as you say, also the argument on values and rights doesn't work when you have to allocate, I don't know, millions of dollars for language access. What really changes the needle or what makes a difference is the amount of money that they are spending on these returning patients. You know, I remember mm-hmm. this patient very clearly that came back with a huge infection on his leg. And the doctor was very angry because there was no reason for him to have the infection after surgery. And I asked, sir, did you have an interpreter upon discharge? And he said, no, they gave me some documents. And I didn't know I was supposed to do this and that after the doctor yelled at him. And what happened to that patient was that he had to be readmitted for 10 more days for an infection. So what is more expensive? Having paid those 2 hours of interpretation services upon discharge, you know, or having to readmit this patient that's probably not going to be able to pay the hospital for 10 days. That's really the argument that is important.
It's also worth remembering that the federal government, with very limited exceptions, does not pay for language access. The funding for language access comes from this provider of the service, whether that's healthcare, education, it could be the Parks and Rec Department making sure that the forms that you need to fill out to reserve a pavilion in a local park for a quinceañera is actually in Spanish, right? I mean, and that's a real thing. And I've helped municipalities with that very specific question in the past. The funding and the principle is under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits discrimination based on race, religion, national origin, gender, and a number of other categories. If you're a covered entity, if your organization, business, government organization, state, local, municipal, whatever, contractor receives federal funding, you're not supposed to discriminate. And you don't get paid extra for not discriminating.
That's not an
you're just
add-on
not
service.
Supposed to do it. You know, it's not an add-on service. Like, you know, you give us a little extra money and we won't discriminate. No. That's not how it works. It's supposed to be something you just do. Now, it is true that there's partial reimbursement for healthcare in language access under Medicaid for roughly 18 states that chose to take that program. Some states supplement that, like Oregon covers the gap in what the federal government doesn't pay for Medicaid interpreting. There are some private insurers that are now paying for interpreters because they've run the numbers and say, well, wait a minute, we provide language access, we're going to spend less money in the long run. There are, as I said, forward-looking data-driven healthcare providers, usually larger healthcare systems, but that's not everybody. But you know, it's not the federal government's job to pay you not to discriminate. It's like, you know, there are disincentives for speeding. And Carol was talking about, you know, driving. One of those is, you know, you get a fine, you could lose your license if you're really driving recklessly. But the real one is that if you get a lot of points on your license, your insurance is going to skyrocket, you know, but you don't get paid extra, you know, nobody's paying me not to speed, right? Not to drive recklessly.
Right.
It's like you're just supposed to do that as part of being a civilized human being living in the society.
Right. But that's why it is important, the conversation on rights and values. Even though people are not paying attention to that type of terminology today, the importance of the conversation is that as the culture changes, then you can leave it in automation, right? Like in what is it called? The cruise control. But the culture has to first change. And I don't think we are there yet when it comes to discrimination on the basis of language. I really think, and this is the source of my work, is we work against language-based discrimination. And I don't think people even understand there is such a thing as language-based discrimination. So before we leave it in cruise control, we have to really talk about rights, about is our right. I really, so going to your point earlier, Tucker, perhaps that's not the argument from services perspective, but it is the argument for the cultural shift,
sure.
Right? People have to understand these are rights, and people that don't speak mm-hmm. English still have to have the right to access, right? Just like the ASL, the people that use ASL for communication, just the same way. If we are not discriminating people that use ASL for communication, we should not discriminate people that use language interpreters. It's the same. Discrimination is the same, whether yeah. you're here or whether you're there, is the same. So let's get there first, and then let's run cruise control and trust that people are not going to do the wrong thing. But I don't think we were there yet. I think this came too soon.
Well, and that's to go into the comments here. The comments are coming faster than I can get to them here. But Flexabilities, sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, on YouTube says, you nailed it, and that the rights aren't where they should be anyways. And that's an interesting argument, because one can talk about the rights that we have according to the federal government, but if ask ourselves the question, are limited English proficient citizens, individuals in this country, even with Executive Order 13166, no. were they receiving satisfactory language access?
And that's my point originally. Right. Yes, that's my point at the beginning, is like, we are not there yet, right? We are still, we think that is fine using children. There was even a movie about this 2 years ago that portrayed how beautiful it was that children would provide interpretation services, when that's absolutely not beautiful at all.
Oh, gosh, yes.
You know, mm-hmm. So let's only start with that. But my point is that our culture needs a tremendous shift, mm-hmm. really, on language. And I think we need to get there. We need to still have the conversation about that, even to the risk of being, I think Renato used the word sanctimonious, to the risk of being sanctimonious and talking too much about rights. I think there is a place for that before you can make any other arguments. You have to first raise the awareness. And what the problem with these 25, 26 million people that don't speak English is that they are not a consolidated identity, right? They don't talk to each other in Chinese and Spanish and say, hey, did you know that we have a right? Let's go and march on Washington. That doesn't happen because there is not an LEP identity. So we, the LSPs, the language services providers, are having to do that for them or inform them. We need to inform people about their rights. I can assure you with the, you know, I spoke to my mechanic this morning. He is from Honduras. He speaks English barely, right? He doesn't know about the right of language access. He has no idea. So like that, there are 25 million people that don't know about their rights. So they are, what's going to happen is that even if the government or even if companies or agencies still provide language access, but what's going to happen? That person that heard, oh my God, now English is the official language of the US, I better don't go to that appointment because I don't have an interpreter to take with me. I'm afraid of going to the court because what if I am asked to speak in English? You know, this the we have to see what can happen to them.
Yeah.
And I think that they are going to get scared.
Well, it's been a challenge for 40 years with language access, if not longer, that the people who need it are often not aware that they have that right. And for all sorts of reasons are reluctant to, you know, pursue that right. They may come from a place where interacting with the government never ended well. And that's, you know, lots of places around the world. Mm-hmm. And they've come here to escape that. They may be concerned about their migration status, their immigration status, you know,
yeah,
or their that of their relatives. There are folks who come to this country who do not have a very high level of education in the home country, especially when we're talking about speakers of lenguas indígenas, indigenous language speakers from Southern Mexico, from Central America, where they're discriminated against there, often provided very few educational opportunities. They come to the States, they get the double discrimination. It's called Latinidad. You know, your name is Volandia, but you actually speak, you know, Chatino, but not Spanish. And we're going to give you a Spanish interpreter. There are all sorts of factors that make it harder for people to pursue their rights. And are there unscrupulous service providers who rely on that? Probably are. I'm not going to say there are for sure, because, you know, I don't want to get in too much trouble. Carol will say they are, I'm sure.
Bill,
you know, but we still have those rights still exist. And part of the role of, you know, umbrella organizations, whether those are, civil rights organizations focused around particular identities, healthcare civil rights organizations, immigration civil rights organizations, is in fact educating their stakeholders, their people, that you have this right and here's how you go get it. And that's still there. The executive order does not take that away. It changes the infrastructure on the federal side potentially. It may change the enforcement through the offices of civil rights. It will not change enforcement through the courts because executive orders don't touch the courts. But just the basic education that you have this right. And on the other side of the table, that yes, the people coming to you, whether it's the Parks and Permit Department or the State Highway Administration or the healthcare provider or whatever, that the people coming to you have that right to communicate. Yeah. And that if you provide that, you're going to have, you know, you're going to do your job more efficiently and more effectively. Those are huge educational challenges that, by the way, will always be there.
But I think that's why part of the interpreter training has to be when we do our introduction to LEP persons and we say who we are and that we are professional interpreters and that everything is going to remain confidential and all this, I think we should say to the LEP, you have a right to language access, for example, right? And I have received pushback over the years on this, but I think it's our role as interpreters to inform people. Because part of the things that I see that can happen is that, and how this will affect professional interpreters, is that they are going to, because granted, the necessity for breaking the language barrier is going to remain there, just as much as the educational piece, right? So we are going to still need to break down that language barrier. But the way people are going to break that language barrier is going to be, oh, but we're going to revert, unfortunately, I think, back to hiring bilingual people, non-professional interpreters, and that's going to impact the professional interpreters that were just gaining the recognition in all these spheres. Oh my God, okay, this is what it means to be a professional interpreter. I better hire someone that's professional. So my fear about with this new order is that because the problem is going to remain, right? We're still going to have to break language barriers. Then we're going to switch to calling whoever because it's less expensive, et cetera. That's one of the problems I see.
Well, the problem's going to remain. And let's be real. The requirement still remains, right? Like this executive order, and I want y'all's opinion on this. How much of this is just another Gulf of the United States? Right? How much of this is just another posturing to the base because of the court cases Bill cited, because of a long history of courts finding that people have a right to language access, particularly in certain situations, because of the profit motive, because many states actually have language access plans and policies in place. I don't see the need, not just the need, I don't see the need, but I don't see the actual language access going away anytime soon because of this order. How wrong am I?
I mean, there's the potential for it. And I think I don't want to say on the margins.
A wise man once said, let's not react to the things that haven't happened yet. At the beginning of this podcast,
yeah, there's potential for it, and there's potential for what Carol's talked about in my mind is empowering people who want to discriminate and giving them the permission structure to discriminate.
Right. Yeah.
Even if the underlying laws and regulations and Supreme Court case law are still there. But it doesn't, in my mind, we're not changing those laws. We're not changing the case laws. There's a lot of speculation about, further actions, but, sustained attention on much of anything has never been this president's strong point through his entire life. They're clearly going to do a lot of anti-immigration things, but I think that this has served its purpose as an anti-immigration signal, anti-immigrant signal, but it'll be interesting, very much, you know, very critical to see what the follow-up is on this.
And mandatory disclaimer that to my fellow Americans listening out there, mandatory disclaimer, not all people that don't speak, a lot of people that don't speak English are U.S. citizens.
Right. Yep. And then we have 3.5 million Puerto Ricans that don't speak English.
Because
what's going to happen with them?
Because I can hear people out there, right, in the Reddit forums saying, well, if you don't want to learn English, go back to your country. Well, this is 80, their country.
Roughly 80% of the children who show up in school in kindergarten or whatever grade not speaking English, roughly 80% of them are either citizens or have some other legal residency status.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't have to pass, when you go through naturalization, if you are under 18, you don't have, I don't know what the exact cutoff, but it used to be minors and elderly did not have to pass the English proficiency, quote unquote, test, English fluency test. And it's pretty rudimentary. And the other part that's worth remembering, we talked about 26 million limited English proficient, which the census defines as those who use a language other than English at home and on the census, and then speak English less than very well. Well, there's another 49 million. I think the total number of people who use a language other than English is now up to about 71 million, because remember, the census was done in 2020. We're 4 years more data and the population continues to grow. You can have folks who've been here for almost 50 years, who may have worked for 30 years in a professional capacity, but have been retired. And now they're elderly and they maybe are dealing with cognitive issues and, you know, not using English, you know, except maybe with the worthless son-in-law. Sorry. And now they need an interpreter when they go to Kaiser. They need an interpreter when they're in, you know, working on, you know, trying to get a permit to do something with their house, or they need that translated. They aren't necessarily tracked as limited English proficient. Depending on the context, that number of 26 million can actually go much higher, because the criteria for being classified limited English proficient are, you know, they're fairly, I want to say they're fairly restrictive. You know, you think about going into a surgery consult for, you know, an elderly person who has a new diagnosis of cancer, you're going to a surgery consult and then a consult with the oncologist. And if that person, that person may well need an interpreter for language that's going to be very technical and very complex and emotionally fraught. And I keep saying that good healthcare systems understand this, good court systems understand this. They say, okay, if there's any issue with communication, we'll get an interpreter for you.
And Tucker, I think in response to your question, I don't think language access services are going to go away. And I actually think on that, the opportunities for, you know, training on language access services, right? And really underscore that that's an essential part of professional training now in the US, right? So I actually see an opportunity there to become more independent when it comes to language access services and just offer training on, you know, how do you work with interpreters? What's the impact of language in the services that you provide? So I don't necessarily see them going away. I just think that the type of ask from people in public services to language services providers is like, why don't you train me on language access? I don't know anything. They are going to see it broader. They're going to see it as language access as opposed to, oh, I just need an interpreter. Oh, I just need a translator. Mm. Now, it could potentially be understood more as a language access issue, which is good. The fact that this whole thing came to the surface is that it's sparking questions on all the people that we need to talk to.
Yeah, we're talking about it now. Right. Mm-hmm. Question for the panelists.
Exactly. I just wanted to say that never before we have had so many things on language access. I've never seen so many things on language access.
Well, I've been working with Bill here for years, and I always struggled when talking to him and trying to sound smart. I always struggled to remember an executive order 13166. And now that it's repealed, I will never forget 13166.
Exactly.
That number is burned into my brain. Go into chat here. And chat, you've been so patient. Thank you so much for the conversation in chat. I'm sorry I haven't been able to get to a lot of your questions. But I'll tell you what, after the live stream is over, we're all going to take a look and respond to whatever we can. But I did see this one pop up from Garrett Bradford. Question for the panelists. Without the federal guidance previously provided by Executive Order 13166, what do you see on the horizon of language access rights enforcement and the rapid adoption of machine translation and AI-based interpreting services, particularly in critical areas like healthcare and court services? So another way of phrasing this question is, how bad will it be once Elon starts taking a look at language access provision?
But I think Garrett raises a really important point about the importance of executive order, that is the enforcement part. So as the agencies don't have the punishment anymore, like if they discriminate now, is going to be, they're not going to take away federal funding, as far as I understand. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But then the enforcement part is not going to be there, right? So as I said at the beginning, it's like you don't have a roadmap anymore, right? So that is obviously going to just test your professionalism, your ethics, in my opinion, right? I think that what's going to happen, at least in healthcare and in other areas of public service, you're going to have to rely on your ethical mandates of providing effective communication. But and as it relates to artificial intelligence, what I can tell Garrett, what I have observed from my company's perspective, and again, my clients are very niche clients. They are always underscoring values. They are very careful with AI because they have a lot of privacy issues or privacy concerns. And my role as an interpreter and as a language services provider is try to guide them through what are the liabilities of AI and how to avoid that risk from their perspective. So I don't think the executive order per se provided any guidance specifically because it was before AI, but that's why I think documents like the one you work on, Bill, and please feel free to talk all about Safe AI, are so important. I mean, the study that you all did. So that's my contribution on that.
Thank you, Carol.
Answering that question.
Yeah, I want to give Bill, yeah, tell us about Safe AI, but I want to come back, put a pin in this, Carol, because I want to come back to you with another question from chat, a follow-up question here. They're coming too quick. Who says, Mark asked Carol, do you see a way to show those hospital schools and courts to see the ROI on language services? I have seen just a few hospitals that understand it can be a marketing tool that actually can bring in dollars. Any studies or tools to make the business case? So think about that while we turn it over to Bill to talk about Safe AI and all that stuff.
So I'll start first with the enforcement piece. There's nothing in the executive order that impinges on enforcement of civil rights, whether through civil rights complaints or through the federal courts. It might be reasonable to speculate that this administration will be less, will have its own priorities when it comes to the enforcement of civil rights and what the offices of civil rights actually follow up on and investigate. We have to act, we have to see what happens. And I hate to be in that kind of reactive position. The career civil servants that understand language access are still all present in the major offices of civil rights. And I don't want to say wait and see until something goes wrong and some horrible harm happens, but this executive order, it's in and of itself, does not affect enforcement because the enforcement pathways are established in law and executive orders can't change that. Now, Safe AI, stakeholders advocating for fair and ethical use of AI, has 600 volunteers from all sorts of different categories of stakeholders, regulators, researchers, client side, enterprise level client side in different sectors, healthcare, education, and so on, interpreters, language services companies, a significant sign language component. We developed a guidance document for the adoption of AI that has four key principles. And the first is transparency in adoption and the accompanying ability to opt out. You have to tell people you're using AI in interpreting, and you have to give them the option to say, no, I'd rather have a human. Second is do no harm. Right, that's the website, and I'm summarizing the second. The second point is do no harm. The AI has to be, you know, as good as the humans, basically. The third is transparency in development, and that really comes down to, does the AI properly account for the kinds of biases that occur in the data? And that's a whole subject for a whole another seminar. And finally, it's accountability for harms and errors. If something goes wrong, who's paying it? Who's paying the damages? I've gotten indirect feedback that the AI interpreting developers think this is too harsh or kind of anti-AI. No, it's not. There's AI will, just as much as machine translation did starting a quarter century ago, it'll change the work. There will be tools that make interpreters in certain cases more productive. You know, the idea that I can use an app to develop a term base, when my first term base, you know, in 1989, I had to develop by hand, and it took me a month, mostly tracking down the, you know, the Russian, English, English, Russian dictionary of astrodynamics, right? Stuff like that. And then learning all the terms. I had an app to do that for me. Well, that's pretty cool. There will be use cases. Just as with machine translation, the use cases of things that are now available in the spoken realm, whether that's through dubbing or subtitling or actually speech-to-speech interpreting, which would never have been interpreted or dubbed or subtitled because it wasn't economically feasible, wasn't worth the effort. And then, so that's the four core principles. And then a further research study laid out, I think, 7 points on a continuum from, you know, speech to speech AI all the way over to humans only, and what kinds of decisions, what kinds of cases would lead to the choice of one or another modality or some mixture. And it's, you know, pretty clear that right now high risk, anything where life, limb, property rights are at risk, is gonna tend to be interpreted by humans, and things that are on the other end of the spectrum are not. Now, that's all by way of saying that, and of course the Trump administration hasn't touched this. Of course the Doge wants to cut AI loose on everything in the government. Okay, see how that works. But what we're seeing now, and at least anecdotally in, for example, the healthcare space, is that healthcare covered entities are dabbling with AI, but usually coming back to the spoken solution because of the liability concerns, because of the accuracy concerns. It's not to say AI isn't accurate. Now, I'll finish my favorite sentence in Spanish. Carol knows the sentence. La vacuna no se necesita. That's a perfectly good sentence. Subject verb.
We've been working together too long because I've heard you say this before.
Yes, and a perfectly good sentence in Spanish. Nothing wrong with it. The original in English is the vaccine is not mandatory. And the MT that was used probably would have gotten that right 97 times out of 100. This one time it didn't get it right. And it's if you were taking the ATA certification exam, I'm pretty sure you would have been told to come back next year because you've changed the meaning of the vaccine is not mandatory versus, you know, the vaccine is not necessary. Okay. And that's because on the other end, the quality control processes, the post-editing review wasn't robust enough to catch the error. Right. And that's kind of danger that I think we're more concerned about with AI. It has nothing to do with the executive order, by the way. Right.
Tucker, I sent you a bibliography to the person that asked me for resources in to sort of making the business case for hospitals. Well, let me remind you that first, we still have a Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act that also prohibits discrimination, that law is safe and sound. And one of the interesting things about this law is that it's going to require training, specific training on language access, right? And that's very important to keep in mind. Then resources that I sent via the chat are the AHRQ study in 2012 on, let me open it here, that was published in 2012, National Healthcare Quality Report, and the Department of Health and Human Services. I don't know if the file is still there, I hope so, but it talks about how people that speak a language other than English or an LEP person suffers four times more severe temporary harm than an English speaker. This is and to me is a startling statistic, right? You're four times more likely to be harmed at a hospital if you don't speak English. The second resource is Spear McCool. I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce his name. He wrote an article on wasteful spending, and I provided the link. And I actually had my bibliography open for me because I did an in-depth research on language access, and I built a course based on all this research, so I had it very handy. And he speaks about the types of wasteful spending, and it links it directly to communication. Now, you have to make a little bit of extrapolation there because you have to understand communication as also multilingual communication, right? He doesn't say anything about LEP. He's not specifically talking about limited English proficiency or language access or anything like that, but he's talking about communication errors that amount to millions and actually billions of dollars in wasteful spending. And these are taxpayer dollars. Let's keep that in mind. So that's how we also link this whole executive order and the impact with our own pockets. I mean, it's going to be more costly unless we have effective language access plans. And then the third one that makes the case for you, and this actually makes not only the case for language access, but also for the use of professional interpreters, is the Flores study on errors of medical interpreters and their potential clinical consequences. That study is absolutely key because it demonstrates that unless you are trained, you're likely to make mistakes. And he has a really interesting chart that shows how they were about 57 encounters that they studied, right? And some of those encounters, 20 of them were done with interpreters, professional interpreters, and the other 20 were done with no interpreters, and then the remainder were done with ad hoc interpreters, meaning bilingual people that were performing as interpreters. And what they found was that they were errors of significant consequence portrayed by the ad hoc interpreters, like 22% were made by ad hoc interpreters. Then no interpreters produced 20% of errors. And then with professional interpreters were 12% of errors. Now, these were regular professional interpreters. If the interpreter has been trained for at least 100 hours, then that percentage of error goes down to 2%. So this is why it's so important to demonstrate that you need to use professional interpreters, and you need to continue to train those interpreters that you work with, because 100 hours apparently makes the difference.
And I just shared those links. And if you're on LinkedIn,
please,
if you're
share those links.
Yeah, if you're watching somewhere other than LinkedIn, go over to the LinkedIn. Sorry, I shared the links there.
And if you don't mind sharing, I just hate the self-promotion, but I wrote an article on all of this that we're talking about 2 years ago, and it's all about the role of language services providers. So
yeah,
it's also useful.
We're going to pull that up because I get to plug you and I get to plug multilingual at the same time. So selfish. Yes. No, but seriously, we were talking about this in the green room, so to speak, before the podcast. And a couple of years ago, Carol wrote an article, and it's also available as a podcast. You can listen to it on what we're talking about today. And it was really prophetic, a lot of the stuff. So I encourage you, I'll drop that link in chat over here on LinkedIn. And I encourage you to go check that out and subscribe to Multilingual, because I'm going to convince her to write another article. for multilingual to follow up on it.
Absolutely. And I will open a shop as a sidekick coming up.
Very cool. Well, I mean, we're looking at the hour. You guys did an excellent job, but you did your job perfectly. You were excellent guests. You kept the conversation going. I did not do a great job because there's so many comments that I did not get to. So if you're listening in chat, thank you so much for being so engaged. And I'm sorry I didn't get to more of the comments and questions. The good news is that Carol and Bill are both real life people with real life LinkedIns and real life email addresses, and they love to talk. Bill's kind of busy these days, but reach out to them directly. Also, I want to give Carol, tell us a little bit about Equal Access Language Services. Tell us about the work that you're doing over there.
Sure. Well, Equal Access Language Services is now really emphatic on training. We are training our companies and organizations on effective inclusion through language access. So in fact, ever since the concept of diversity, equity, and inclusion became so important, it has always been important, but I understood it as an important introduction to language access, right? Even though language access is a right, and I don't mean to say by any means of that it necessarily belongs to the diversity, equity, and inclusion space. My question is always, what inclusion if we are leaving 26 million people out? So I'm training on that heavily. That's what my company does, is providing language access training. And also we do interpretation and translation, but our vision is to eliminate language-based discrimination and really support companies that want to do the same thing by training them.
Very good. Thank you so much. Bill, what would you like to plug today? You work on so much stuff, I never know what to plug for you.
Well, you know, pay attention to safeaitf.org, which I know Tucker shared the link. There's a upcoming hearing of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights on Language Access. I've been invited to testify. That's on March 21st, so that's 2 weeks from Friday. And I'll be talking about the executive order, and I'll be talking about the role of AI. And just, you know, stay tuned. And a lot of my work is, you know, I lobby, as I said, but a lot of my work is in, you know, helping enterprise-sized organizations, municipalities, state governments, et cetera, sort out their language access policies and practices, and illuminating for them some of the nuances that they really have to consider, you know, relay interpreting for lenguas indígenas, but also for deaf individuals who are not proficient in ASL, things like that. But, you know, I work closely with NIMSI, and you can find me on LinkedIn and hit me up there.
Very good. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Carol. I think I will just try to keep it to an hour today. I think we probably could have gone for another hour, but gotta know when to quit here. So I'll take us out here. Ladies and gentlemen, chat, we are out of time for today. If you enjoyed this NIMSI Live experience, and join us next time on March 13th when we are running a Lessons in Localization session with Julia Cassidy from SurveyMonkey. If you are not already signed up, make sure to sign up via LinkedIn events for the upcoming session. Once again, and finally, my name is Tucker Johnson, host of NIMSI Live, and it has been my pleasure to join you all today. I appreciate our guests, Carol and Bill. I appreciate my colleagues here at NIMSI Insights doing all the hard work so I can have these fun conversations. And I appreciate everybody in our industry who fills out NIMSI surveys, schedules briefings with our analysts, talks to us, gives money to us, contracts our services. You guys make this thing possible for me to be able to do this. And finally, I appreciate you, the audience, who are joining us live today. I appreciate all of the dialogue and chat, everyone who left comments, questions, and especially criticisms. And I look forward to next time. Cheers.